Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there from Bedford. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I've got my second interview with Taj Dryger, who is a research scientist at MIT's Digital Currency Initiative, and we discuss U3XO. But before that, I've got a message from my show sponsors. So first of all, this week's show is brought to you by Acquainting. And now that some of you are making money again with Bitcoin, with the price back on the rise, looking pretty stable above 10K, are you prepared for tax season? If you are taking your tax seriously, then you must take a look at Acquainting. It is without doubt the best crypto tax solution on the market. And not only that, they have a badass portfolio tracking solution, so you can optimize your trades to reduce your tax burden. Not only is it the best, but it's also the best priced tax calculator in the market, and you only pay at the point where you want your report. I've played with it. It's pretty cool. As you know, I always go on about UX, how important it is, and they've absolutely nailed it. It's super easy to use. You can import your data from all major exchanges and wallet providers. So if you are taking your tax seriously, you got to check out Acquainting. Head over to acquainting.com, which is acquainting.com. That is acquainting.com, which is acquainting.com. And also, this show is brought to you by Dropbit, the best mobile Bitcoin wallet. There is the best in the world. I've played with it so much. I go on about it all the time. I tweet about it. I use it everywhere I go. Whenever I'm traveling, I load up my wallet and I'm giving Bitcoin to people all the time. And I'm also receiving it, although I'm not receiving as much as I'm sending out. So I'm not stacking sats. I'm giving away sats with my Dropbit wallet. But I'm cool with that because I love it and I want you guys using it as well. It is like a Venmo for Bitcoin. It is so easy to use. They've made it so you can not only send to an address, of course you can do that, but you can also send to a mobile phone number and you can even tweet people Bitcoin. I've been tweeting Bitcoin to people recently. You should check that out. So go on, definitely download it. I might even send you some Bitcoin if you do. It's available on the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. That is dropbit.app. Which is dropbit.app. Okay, so on to this week's interview. And when I was in Boston on my last US trip, I managed to catch up with Taj, and he is the co-author of the Lightning White Paper. We did an interview about that before, so you should definitely check that out. But he also recently released a new white paper looking at Bitcoin scaling. It's called U3XO, a dynamic hash-based accumulator optimized for the Bitcoin UTXO set. You got that? Oh, and also an interesting side story. He co-authored the Lightning White Paper with Joseph Poon, who I also met at my party in San Francisco, but I didn't realize it was him, and he totally trolled me. Well played, Joseph. We will get you on the show as well at some point. So anyway, back to U3XO, and being super technical myself, being an absolute Bitcoin technical genius, I knew I had to talk to him about this and debate it with him. Obviously, I'm not. But yes, it was great to sit down and talk about it, get a pretty high-level overview from Taj on what he's trying to achieve with U3XO. It's very cool. But it was also good to hear Taj talk about Lightning again and how he is leaving it in the trusted hands of other developers. And it was also cool to talk to him about what some of the key Bitcoin devs in the space think about other coins and technologies, upcoming developments for Bitcoin, whether everyone should be running a node, whether he will escape to the forest if Ripplecoin or Libra do become the standard, God help us if they do, and get an insight on the goings on in the Bitcoin conferences when the developers get together and have a meeting. That was super cool, very interesting to hear about that. Anyway, loved this. Talking to Taj is so easy. I hope you enjoy it too. If you've got any questions, you can always reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Looks like I'm going back out to the States again next week, which is great because I'm already super jet lagged and shattered, but I've got some opportunities to do some really cool interviews. So yes, looks like I'll be heading back out, definitely to LA, definitely to San Francisco. Might be hitting Washington and New York as well, and maybe even Austin. So look, as I know my schedule, I'll tweet about it. If you're in any of these places you want to hang out, let me know. Also, getting ready for the launch of my new podcast, Defiance. If you haven't seen it, the website's live, and it's got the podcast manifesto written by Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. You can check that out at www.thedefiancepodcast.com. If you want to support the show, head over to my website, whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section. I've also got a Patreon top tier sponsor to thank, VidYen, makers of vidhash.com, where demonetized YouTube content creators can earn Monero, which you can then sell for Bitcoin when fans watch via their web mining links. That's vidhash.com, which is VIDHASH.com. Okay, I've spoken enough already. I know some of you hate my long intros. Well, you're probably not listening now anyway, because you've probably forwarded it. So yeah, whatever. But yeah, anyway, hope you enjoy the interview. You know, if you've got any questions, you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. It doesn't bother me too much, the Facebook coin.
Like, it, yeah, I'm not going to touch it, but...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but I can see why some people would. I wouldn't use it, but
yeah, it's big enough that a lot of people can get, you know, if it hurts a lot of people's privacy, things like that.
Yeah.
But it's also like, so I bought a place an hour and a half outside of Boston, and I sort of joke, it's like a prepper cabin that in case Ripple XRP takes over, I won't be able to use money. So I have to live in a cabin in the woods. And similarly with Facebook coin, if it takes over and that's the only money in the world, well, I'm not going to touch it. So.
Yeah, I mean, if it was the only money in the world, that would be quite scary. But then
probably not.
We got people like you trying to give us a better money.
Yeah, but you never know. Like, you know, Trump won. Like, who knows what happens? Like,
could he win? Could he win again?
Who knows? Like, you just don't know. Like, yeah, uncertainty. So
that's why we need Bitcoin, man.
Yeah. So hopefully Bitcoin. I don't know. But although, to be honest, I rarely use Bitcoin. Like, I have a full node, and I look. I'm like, use it. Three times in this year so far. Like, it's you know, in practice, I don't use it much, so.
It's because you're saving it for the future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I use it occasionally. You know, if people just pay for things, get reimbursed, stuff. I always ask, like, hey, I'll use Bitcoin. But it's just still not widely used, I guess.
Yeah, I found recently I used to use it quite regularly for invoicing and paying. I've using it more for invoicing, less for paying now, because I don't want to have to go and stock up again because it's a pain. So I'm like, can I pay you with PayPal, but can you pay me in Bitcoin?
Well, Gresham's law, right? You're like, I'd rather get rid of the regular money and take. So it's funny, I got reimbursed for a conference flight, and they asked, okay, we can pay you Ether. And I'm like, oh no, I can't accept Ether. I don't know. Well, and I've never touched it. I was like, I could do Bitcoin or just, you know, check or whatever. And they're like, okay, Bitcoin. I'm like, interesting. They offered Ether first, but
yeah. Well, maybe they want to offload it.
Yeah, I don't know. So.
I was watching a Neha presentation this morning from the Bitcoin Expo. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, Taj says no to everything and says everything sucks.
I'm very skeptical about things. And in general, just because the priors, right? Like, so many of the things we look at are wrong or scams or broken that I sort of prejudice, right? You just default. You're like, oh, here's a blockchain white paper. I'm like, yeah, it's a scam. Because 99% of the time it is. But there is that 1% that's like really good and really new and interesting stuff. So you do have to still sort of read it and look at it. But yeah, I definitely am guilty of prejudging things.
Are they scams or are they just shit?
There's a spectrum, right? Sometimes people believe their own stuff to be true. And there was a paper last night, and it was not malicious. It was saying that Bitcoin mining is not a Poisson process. And actually, it was funny, Neha and I had an argument a few days ago about Poisson processes. And I was like, this is a Poisson process. She's like, technically it's not. And so she sort of posted this. And the paper was wrong. But it was sort of like infuriating because it's like, it's this whole big paper. There's all this math. But it's like fundamentally wrong. And they got it wrong. You know, it's like that comic, someone's wrong on the internet kind of thing. So, but then again, there's also things where you can't be charitable. Like BitConnect kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Where you're like, no, come on. This is a scam. This is people are knowingly and willingly doing this. PayCoin, or have you ever heard of Banks? BANX? It was 3 years ago.
Maybe.
You could only buy it, you could never sell it, so the price only went up. It was like it was like so obvious, but you know, you're gonna find people who buy into it. So there's a big spectrum of like honest attempts that maybe people buy into their own ideas and think that's gonna change the world, and then it doesn't, versus, you know, just outright like fraudulent stuff.
So what gets in the 1%?
Oh, there's a lot of fun stuff recent. I think a really good example is Taproot, or the, I'm sure you've talked to Pete, like Andrew Polstra?
Yeah, maybe, Polstra. Yeah, I'm with him in New York a few weeks ago. We covered Taproot.
So the Taproot equation, it's like one line. I think it was posted 2 years ago or early 2017, I believe. I don't remember exactly when. But you just look at, you know, for people who are familiar with elliptic curve stuff and this cryptography, you look at that one line, you're like, oh, yeah. Why didn't we think of that? it's so clear, and you can do so many things with this, and it's like obviously right, just no one had thought of it. So things like that where you don't even need there's no paper about Taproot. It's just like, hey, one line, cool. And then other things that people are working on, the mini sketch, the set reconciliation stuff that like Peter Wool and Gleb and people are working on. That is something like I don't quite understand. Like you look at it, I'm like, I could try to understand this math, and I could maybe get it, but it would take me a long time. Like, but it's trust. I'm like, okay, I know these people. I think it works. I'm not gonna like spend the week to figure out the coding theory and stuff to understand that it works.
But this is all stuff in Bitcoin. Is there anything getting in the 1% outside of Bitcoin?
So, maybe more controversial. I think Zcash is. It's weird, like the founder's reward and some things like that, and transparency. Like, yeah, maybe it's weird. But fundamentally, they're trying to do research, and it's legit research on how to get better privacy for things like Bitcoin. Maybe some of the research there could be applied to Bitcoin. So I Monero, things like that. Some of the privacy coins are Mimblewimble coins, like Grin, where it's like, yeah, you could say it's an altcoin, and like a lot of people don't really like altcoins, sure. But there's interesting research going there, and like, it could benefit everyone. And even maybe to some extent, some of the Ethereum stuff. I pay attention to Ethereum. I know a lot of people who work on Bitcoin are like, oh, it's junk. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with a lot of the decisions that Ethereum makes, but I think it's a good idea to look at what happens because of those decisions. So to some extent, like, you know, scalability is the big thing in Bitcoin and all these systems. And if it were the case in like Bitcoin Cash that they actually had a lot more users, then it would be an interesting case to look at, okay, what happens when you do have really large blocks and you are, you know, cranking up the system, and is it as bad as we were? You know, people worry, oh, if you just have unlimited block size, you're going to have all these problems in Bitcoin. But we've never tested that, right? And Bitcoin Cash doesn't test that, because even though they have larger block limits, in practice, there's much less traffic on the network.
Bitcoin SV tests it. They've got gigamegs.
Yeah, but it's also, it's hard because it's all sort of generated by a script. And so, I remember when SegWit was testing, I made consistent 3.7 megabyte blocks on Bitcoin testnet for days. But it wasn't real, right? It was not a script.
Proper test.
So it's hard. But whereas in Ethereum, like, they do have a lot harder scalability constraints than Bitcoin does. And a big part of it is the design of the system, where, like, everything can call into everything else. So there's a lot more interconnectivity. And so you can't really run it on a computer with a hard drive. Not really. You can't run it at all. And even with an SSD, the resource requirements are higher. And so we see problems in Ethereum that people may have worried about in Bitcoin, but we haven't seen yet. And so I think it's a good idea to look at all these things. You know, Ethereum still runs. It still works. But it's very hard to run a full node. And, like, how does that affect the network? So
Therefore, is it really decentralized?
Well, yeah. Like, to what extent it matters? I don't, you know, so... So that is the argument, like, and some people are, you know, Luke Jr., like, it should be 300 kilobytes, and you need to run it on Raspberry Pis and stuff. And I don't necessarily think I think most Bitcoin programmers don't really agree with Luke. He's sort of on the extreme edge. Mm. And then there's other people say, yeah, unlimited is fine, we'll figure it out. But where in there? Like, a lot of it's sort of religious almost, and there's not a lot of data. So I do think it makes sense to look at these other systems and the choices they made. What other systems have good new research? I don't know. So there are some.
I mean, I guess there's also a benefit with these forks. Again, I was watching Nihar's presentation about catastrophic attacks, and you have different developers finding problems in different... I can't remember the name of it. Amory, who found it, the Bitcoin inflation bug?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. I think
that was following Corey Field finding one.
I thought it was a denial of service and then reported it, and then... There was a little bit trickier way to make it into an inflation bug, and they tried to not report that part and fix the whole thing, but then it got out. So
But there is that kind of relationship between competing coins, that if you find something, there's a process of disclosing it to each other.
Yeah.
So I guess you get that as well. But
yes, and that's the tricky part. You got to sort of draw a line where, okay, we'll report vulnerabilities to these coins, but not these other coins, because these other coins are not trustworthy and they're so small. And if we report it to all of them, there's hundreds of them. That's basically making it public. So it's tricky.
Right, yeah, because if you let them know, they might try and attack other coins rather than deal with it. Yeah.
Or there's all these tiny little coins that, like, what is this? Who is it? It's anonymous. Like,
yeah,
you could report, but it's hard to know.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
Well, listen, our first interview got some mixed feedback, but mostly good. Everyone really enjoyed it. I think people were glad to hear from you. We're definitely intrigued that you kind of moved away from Lightning. You're working on something new. And then you were telling me about Utrexo.
Mm-hmm.
You got the paper out.
Yep, that was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
a week and a half. I don't know. Yeah, so fairly recently. It's still okay paper.
I read it. I mean, I say I read it. I read the abstract. Read the first two or three pages, and then when you start getting into the heavy math and tech, I was like, okay.
Well, the math at the last section is a bit hand wavy, and I would like to sort of firm that up. And it's interesting ideas, but I sort of have no proofs or anything at the end.
I was just like, oh, well, if I'm going to talk to you, I can let you explain it. Then
sure,
and read it to myself. But I mean, how long does it take to write a paper like that?
So the process with this, let's see, the general idea of like, hey, let's not keep the whole UTXO set is a fairly old one. But this specific case with UTXO, I remember at Financial Crypto last year, talking to Peter Wool, Sipa, and a couple other people, and They had been working on ideas for how to use accumulators for a little while. Corey Fields also had asked about he lives here now.
Yeah.
He moved a few weeks ago, which is cool. But he was remote for a while. And we'd meet, he'd come every few months. He'd ask me about, like, hey, so this identity-based encryption. And I'm like, oh, yeah, no, it's garbage. Wait, why are you reading those papers? And he's like, but there's so many papers and so much math. I'm like, yeah, but it's not useful. Which is sort of a silly thing to say. There are useful mathematical constructs. But if you've ever looked at identity-based encryption, the fundamental premise is sort of like, wait, that's silly. Why? You can't use that. But it leads to really cool math. And so there's a lot of academic papers about it, which then have led to useful things. But the sort of starting point was not related to accumulators. So at Financial Crypto, Peter Wool was saying, the problem with all these accumulators is you're going to need a bridge node. That whenever you start this system, you're transforming from, we keep track of all the different coins, to we don't know what the coins are, and people give proofs. And that does seem like a better system, because it puts the cost of maintaining all this data onto the people who have all the coins. So if you're an exchange and you have a million UTXOs, well, that million UTXOs is on my hard drive and someone else, everyone's hard drive who's running a full node. And that seems like an externality. It seems like, okay, someone who's, polluting the network, that cost is borne by everyone. Whereas in a model with an accumulator, no, now that person who's got the million UTXOs now needs to keep and manage the million proofs. And everyone else has to just have to verify the proofs when the transactions happen. So that seems nicer. But Sipa was saying, the problem is you need a bridge node. You need a node that can stick a proof onto any transaction that basically has all the proofs, which is worse even than the current storing the whole UTXO set. And in all the constructions he was looking at, it was impractical. Not impossible, but basically impossible, where you're saying, okay, there's 60 million UTXOs right now, but that could go way up. That could be 100 million, 500 million. And all of them are going to need to be updated every time a block comes in. And potentially, so that's, hundreds of millions of updates in every block. And it can be even worse if it's every transaction updates them. So you're going to have, 50 million times 5,000, which is huge number of operations. So that sort of felt like a dead end or like a brick wall. And then what actually happened was last summer, I was working on discrete law contracts stuff, and Neha sort of said, Taj, we need to write a new paper. We're at MIT, we need papers, like, new paper, what do we write about? And it's like, okay, whiteboarding. And I'm like, all right. And she suggested, what about like decentralized exchanges? I'm like, I don't know, I'm not into that. And I said, well, what about these accumulators? Like, there's a bunch of ideas, but it didn't seem to quite be possible, but I bet there's a way. And it went through many iterations of sparse Merkle trees, not so sparse Merkle trees, prefix trees, all these different ideas. I ended up with a Merkle tree design that's not that far from regular old Merkle trees, And it was influenced a lot. Sofia Nakubov, I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong, but she's at Boston University now. And actually, Ethan Hillman suggested, she's like, he was like, hey, you need to talk to Sofia. She does really good work on accumulators. So I just met her, this was last fall, and she explained her paper a bit. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So it builds a lot off of that design.
Right, okay.
But is a change to it. And is basically a Merkle tree-based accumulator where you can add and remove.
And is that pretty much all you've been working on since last fall? Or are you working on a variety of things at the same time?
So there's a bunch of students that I work with.
Yeah.
There's always like meetings and events and talks and things like that. But the main research focus has then been that since early this year. Yeah.
Okay. And how much of the time is spent writing? How much of the time is spent thinking? How much is spent coding? Like, how do you balance this all?
So sometimes it's just like the thinking. You just have like piles of papers. The thinking part is like kind of fun because you feel all smart and you're making new things. And the thing that really helped was I wrote a program to make printouts of binary trees.
Okay.
And that saves so much time. Because like I was spending so much time drawing little like Merkle trees on paper. I'm like, no. Write a program to print them. And now I can just draw like arrows between the things. And so some of it's, you know, paper, pencil and paper, coming up with ideas. And those are fun because then you're like, oh, wait, this works. And you run and try to code it. And a lot of it was coding. And a lot of it was dead ends in coding.
Right.
Where I was like, wait, oh, no, this runs out of memory. Or, oh, no, this... And then writing the paper was also quite a while, and I didn't like writing the paper. I don't like LaTeX and making the diagrams getting it all. I was like, why can't I just explain it to people? So I don't, that part was somewhat frustrating, and like trying to get it to be a paper, because it's never like good enough. Whereas with code, you're like, aha, this is
it works or it doesn't, right? Yeah.
But even then, it's like, this is optimal. Like, it's optimal. Like, yeah. I got it to work the best way, and this is the best algorithm, or this is. You know, this is really working well. Whereas the paper, it's like, you know, it's a lot more diffuse and hopefully people understand it. Hopefully it's written well, but like, it's not that great. Yeah.
And were other people helping you? You know, someone like Andrew Polster, was he helping? Or Peter Wheel? Do you have people to call on for help with this? Or is it just pretty much a lone project?
A little bit. This one was weird. It just became like a lone thing because it was like, okay, I'm just going to finish this.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, and like I talked to Corey a little bit, but it was sort of like, well, at this point, it's so much my work that I should just finish it myself, I guess. And it was a little weird because it's like I sort of was like, well, maybe I should try to get a bunch of other people involved and make it. But I was a little bit greedy. I was like, well, it's been mostly me so far, so if I'm just the only author, that's like, I get more credit. Yeah. I don't know. but at this point now, it's like, okay, I do want to work with other people. James O'Byrne at Chaincode Labs, I was talking to 2 weeks ago.
And Will's brother.
Sorry?
He's brother Willowburn, right? They're brothers.
I guess? I don't know.
I think so. Because I met a James in New York.
Yeah, he works at Chaincode Labs.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure he's Will's brother. I could be wrong.
Oh, okay. Same last name?
You know Will.
I guess.
I think they are. Okay. We'll find out when this goes out.
Interesting. But so he's working on something called Assume UTXO in Bitcoin. And I was sort of like, wait, UTXO can sort of fit in here. And so that might be the first place it starts to get into Bitcoin Core. And there's a lot of discussion where I eventually do want to get this UTXO into Bitcoin Core and it becomes just a option or maybe even a default in how Bitcoin works. Probably not a default. But that's a whole big process and there's a lot of software still to write there.
What's the feedback been from the team at Core?
Most people are into... So there's a range. Some people don't think it's a good idea.
Okay.
Or think, okay, but this is not really practical or this isn't solving the problem that we have. And I think to some extent, like I mentioned it to Greg Maxwell on IRC and he's like, but the problem is bandwidth. So if you think that the problem with Bitcoin scalability now is that you have to download too much and there's too much network traffic, then yeah, UTXO doesn't help at all. It makes it worse. Whereas Peter Wool, I think he was more enthusiastic and some other people were like, oh, this is really good. Because if you think the bottleneck is hard drive space or SSD, you need an SSD or you need a lot of hard drive space and it's very slow on hard drives, then this helps a lot. So depending on what your bottleneck is, and it depends on your computer, right? So I was joking in Amsterdam that if you have a nice new laptop and you're trying to sync Bitcoin on the airplane, UTXO is absolutely the wrong solution. It's sort of a joke, but like you could be in a situation where you've got good computers and really crummy network access, mm-hmm. and this helps not at all. Don't use it. Versus the other extreme would be like a network router or something where you've got plenty of bandwidth, you're plugged right into the internet, but you've got a very, you know, low resources in terms of memory and storage and stuff like that. So this would be great for that. So, you know, and it's nice in that it's optional. It's not even a soft fork. So no one, I don't think anyone's been like, no, this is a bad idea. Don't do it. The only feedback, the less positive feedback has been, I don't think this is really solving the problem we need to solve. So, okay, you can do it. I guess it's nice to have as an option, but this doesn't seem to be the critical path versus other people who say, no, this is what a lot of people is stopping them from running full nodes.
So. Yeah, okay, so let's break it down. So I'm not sure if you remember, but most of the people, I think, listen to my podcast aren't the most technical,
sure,
won't understand everything. So we'll go into the details. So firstly, this is about optimizing nodes, and hopefully more people will run nodes because mm-hmm. you identified a lower proportion of people. So we've got an increase in the amount of people running nodes, but it's a reducing percentage of those
probably
adopting Bitcoin.
It's hard to measure. It's yeah. really, it's really noisy data. So you've got this sort of, oh, there's 6,000 or 7,000, which is the publicly accessible Bitcoin nodes.
Yeah.
But then there's also, I think Luke Jr. says, oh, I listen in and I say there's 10 times that many, but it's really hard to know. And there's so many fake nodes and it's not a number you can really get a good handle on.
Luke was saying to me that he thinks we need to target having 80% of people with Bitcoin having a full node.
It's again, it's like more seems better,
yeah.
right? But like, where do you get the number 80%? I don't
yeah.
know, maybe 70%. Like,
well, I don't think you get that many people there anyway. I just don't think that many people are going to do it.
Yeah. Oh, it's hard. I have a full node, sure, but you know, I work on this stuff.
Yeah.
But I also, depends who owns Bitcoin. So like, my dad has Bitcoin, but really, it's just I have them. And like, you know, he trusts me. Well, yeah, I'm dad, you know.
Yeah.
And I have said, hey, you should. And he said, yeah, maybe once I retire, I'll try to figure this, you know, Bitcoin stuff out and I'll run my own full node.
Yeah.
But for now, I don't know this stuff and you just take care of it for me. So there's a lot of things like that where it's scary. It's imposing. Even at the DCI, there's people who are not programmers, but, you know, we always work on Bitcoin. And there's coworkers who don't have full nodes. And they've said, yeah, I should run one. But like, I don't know, man. It looks like a lot of work. It's scary. There's a lot of space. And it's like, oh, we need to get rid of this idea that it's a really hard thing to do. Because I don't think in practice, you know, I'm probably not the best person to ask, but I think it's not as hard as people think. And especially with pruning, even today, it's, you know, 5-10 gigabytes of storage, which isn't that bad. And people have the idea, oh, it's 250 gigabytes. And the thing is, by default, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a discussion with a lot of the core developers. Hey, should default be to prune? Because it's not a security problem to do so. But there's a bunch of issues there. So maybe someday it'll be default pruned.
So do you have a choice of having download the entire set or the prune set?
So download, no. So either way, you have to download the whole thing.
Yeah, okay.
Currently, with the current software. But you don't have to keep it all. So you could download 250 gigabytes, but only keep 10 of them.
Right. Something but like does that. It automatically choose that for you?
No. By default, if you just download Bitcoin Core, it'll keep everything.
How do you know what to get rid of then?
So you go in the settings and you say, I want to prune only keep the last 5 gigabytes or something.
Right, okay.
And then the software does it for you. And that's been there for years.
And why can you do that? Why do you not need the old, say, 230 gigabyte?
Yeah, so there's two fundamental aspects. There's the blockchain, which
yep.
is the history of everything that's happened.
Yep.
And then a bit less known is the UTXO set, the
yep.
set of who owns what. So if you know, I paid someone 5 years ago, that transaction isn't actually relevant to today,
yep.
right? All those coins are gone. Everything has moved. So there is a set of who owns what, and then there's a set of all the transactions that ever happened. And the way you get to who owns what is by replaying everything that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the everything that ever happened is 250 gigs or so. And that's the big blockchain, and that's hard. But the set of who owns what is a lot smaller. It's about 4 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 60, 70 million, it keeps changing, total unspent outputs, or so total bitcoins that can be spent. Not individual bitcoins, but individual outputs. So the whole point of downloading the blockchain is to get to that set. And you can throw the history away once you've done so. Because probably the only real reason to keep the history is to give it to other people. So if other people say, hey, I downloaded Bitcoin, can you tell me the history? You can serve it to them. But you don't need everyone to be able to do that, I guess.
Right, okay. Yeah, okay. And what do you make a neutrino?
Neutrino is basically SPV. It's an improvement to the previous way of doing SPV.
I mean, I don't fully understand it, but SPV does have privacy problems, right?
SPV's got a bunch of different problems. So the idea of a full node is you download the whole history. You can throw away the history once you've verified it, but you've checked everything. And then the idea of SPV is, well, I'm not going to keep a UTXO set. I fundamentally don't have a set of who owns what. So, but what I do have is I can trust the miners to some extent and say, well, this transaction got mined 10 blocks ago. The whole network seems to be going along with it, so it's probably fine. And in most cases, that works. Like, because if most people are running full nodes and checking, then the miners will quickly turn away from an invalid block and start building valid ones. So SPV does have that sort of a little bit of a trust, not a little bit, it's a significant trust assumption that the miners are mining correct blocks, that other people are validating it for you so you don't have to validate it, which in practice works, right? In practice, there currently are, but it is sort of risky and it feels scary because you're giving them a lot of power. So that's one sort of security aspect. And then the privacy aspect is, because you don't want to download everything, and this is somewhat orthogonal, because you don't want to download everything, you have to somehow download the right thing and the things that concern you. So the simplest way to do that is to say, here are all my addresses, tell me something, tell me if I gained or lost any money. But that here are all my addresses part is, I just lost all my privacy. I just linked all my addresses. I told some random person on the internet all of my addresses.
Mm.
And the initial way, so if you have a website, like if you're using a Block Explorer and you just paste in your address, say, hey, do I have any money? Well, now they know your address. Or if you paste in all of your addresses, now they know all of them and they've linked that to your IP address.
Yeah.
And, so that's privacy-wise not very good. The older way, which is we used Bloom filters, and that's from 2012 or 13, I forget. And that initially was thought to maybe have okay privacy properties.
Mm-hmm.
There was still some sort of, I don't know about this kind of things at the time, and it turned out to have very poor privacy, where you make this Bloom filter, which is sort of a hash, kind of, you smush together all your addresses and send that, and the problem is the receiving end, those nodes could pretty easily figure out what your addresses were from that Bloom filter. And it ended up being very close to, here's all my addresses, tell me about my transactions. Neutrino flips that a bit, and instead of saying, here's all my addresses, tell me about the transactions in this block that relate to me, the nodes that do have the whole block create essentially a Bloom filter, not exactly the same, but create a compact representation of the block, and then you can download that. And then you can check yourself if anything in this block looks interesting to you. And sometimes you get a false positive. So sometimes you download this few kilobyte thing and say, oh, is there anything in this block that is paying me? Because I want to know if I got money. And, oh, it looks like there is. You download the whole block, which is, a megabyte something. And then you see, oh, no, nothing in there actually relates to me. So there is a false positive, but that's okay. Occasionally false positives. But in most cases, you see a hit and you download the block and you're like, here's where I got some money or my money got spent. So that helps privacy a lot because now all the nodes see is you're occasionally downloading blocks. And it's real hard for them to say, well, he's probably got something in this block and something in that block, but they're so big that you don't really know. So it makes it less efficient in terms of download, but you gain a big privacy gain there. So it's definitely better, but it's still SPV. So it's sort of like, it's a help, but you're still using this SPV thing. You're still trusting the miners. You're not validating yourself. I think Neutrino is sort of like making SPV better and more secure, and then U3XO is coming from the other direction saying, okay, let's make full nodes easier to run. So running a Neutrino-based SPV node, it's still lower cost, easier than running U3XO, but we're trying to sort of come at it from both angles, I guess.
Well, I guess Neutrino feels like it solves a lot of problems more for mobile devices anyway.
Yeah, it's easier to run. You can definitely run one on a phone. The goal for something like U3XO is, hey, can we get it so that you can reasonably run full nodes on a phone? That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
We're not quite there yet, but I bet we can get there.
Next up, I talked to Taj more about Bitcoin techie stuff. But before that, I've got a message from my amazing sponsors. So firstly, we're going to talk about Kraken. Come on, are you using Kraken yet? If not, why? Who are you trusting over Kraken for your Bitcoin trades? Who do you think does a better job? Because I don't believe anyone does. It is, for me, the single best exchange in the world for buying and selling Bitcoin. It's the only exchange I use because I trust them more than anyone. And I know they're a sponsor, but I would trust them anyway. They do so much for the industry, especially Kraken Security Labs, which is their dedication to improving security across the industry. They don't just have the exchange. They don't just have Kraken Security Labs. They've also got the Kraken OTC desk for large trades with private and personalized services. They've got CryptoWatch, where you can trade on multiple crypto exchanges from a single platform. They offer margin trading, futures, and indices. They've pretty much got your back covered with everything to do with trading. So come on, join me in supporting Kraken, the best exchange in the world. Head over to kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N.com. That is kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N.com. And last this week, but never, ever least, is BlockFi. They're never least because they've supported the show for so long. They're my oldest sponsors. Love them so much. Big shout out to Zach Prince. You my man. Thank you so much for supporting the show for so long. Thank you for renewing for another year. I've just received my third payout from their interest accounts. And we're not talking about small amounts of money here. I've got a nice little nest egg building up there. My Bitcoin is working for me. Yes, you should do your own research. And yes, you should be aware that if you do use their interest accounts, you are handing over your private keys. I did mine. I trust them and my Bitcoin is working for me. They are also now offering support for the Gemini stablecoin across the platform. BlockFi interest account clients at launch are eligible for 6.2% APY, paid monthly with balances of 2,500 GUSD and above. Balances over 100,000 GUSD will earn a tiered rate of 1.5% APY. BlockFi also offers GUSD and USD as a funding option and as collateral for institutional crypto borrowers. And BlockFi's USD loan rates start as low as 4.5%. And they've got their crypto-backed loans. They're doing so much for the future of Bitcoin and financial services. I love BlockFi. If you are interested in trying them out, as I said, do your own research, then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. That is BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. All right, so U3XO, just so people, because there are going to be people listening to this who might not even understand this, they might not even understand how UTXOs work themselves and how they're generated.
They are kind of weird.
they're kind of interesting. I was looking at them recently because I was trying to track the 82.15 Bitcoin that Satoshi sent to Mike Hearn, and then went back. And that was one of my first times to really start looking at UTXOs.
Yeah.
And I obviously got taken back to a Coinbase.
So one of the problems is the Block Explorers are kind of wrong.
Oh, well,
and for years they have showed addresses as where Bitcoins live. And it's sort of like Bitcoins live at addresses is sort of what people think and what the Block Explorers show. So if you click on an address, it says this address has a balance. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoins have come in and Bitcoins have gone out.
Yeah.
And when you see a transaction, it shows, okay, from address 1350 to address 703. But that's not how it works. Bitcoin, so
great, okay. So another day where I'll learn something new.
So Bitcoins don't live at addresses. Bitcoins live at UTXOs or TXOs, transaction outputs, which have addresses. So it lives in this box and you can slap an address on it, but the address is a property of this box. It's not that it lives in an address and has this UTXO associated with it. So you can slap the same address on 100 different boxes. So if you can have, you know, coins get sent to 1,000 different UTXOs, which all have the same address, but they are different UTXOs, and you can pick which one you want to spend. And from the software's point of view, the fact that they have the same address, you never even see that. They live in these little UTXOs, and that's where they live. And so when you're spending, you specify the specific UTXO you're spending. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's this address or that address, or no address. You know, you can have UTXOs that live and there's no address at all. Or it's some weird non-standard thing, or there's an op return, or, you know, things like that. So really, when a Block Explorer says money comes from here, it shouldn't show an address. It should show a transaction ID, and little, you know, index within the transaction ID. And some explorers do show that. Sometimes it's like a little arrow, like they show both, things like that. So, but from the way the software works, it's you're spending an output.
I think for a user, though, it's like a UX thing, having it from an address. It feels like the right thing.
It feels like it's easier to understand because it's closer to what we think about with like bank account balances and stuff.
Yeah.
But it isn't how Bitcoin works, and there are important differences. So like Ethereum, on the other hand, has balances.
Okay.
And so an address in Ethereum is where the coins or where the Ether lives. So when you send to this address, and that's like where it stays. And then when you spend from an address, and it comes out of there in decrements. But it's not in Bitcoin, and that can burn people. Like with paper wallets, you think, oh, there's money on this address, I'll spend some of it. No, you have to spend all of it, right? Like, so people have gotten burned where if you don't spend the whole UTXO, you're like, okay, here's 10 coins, I'll spend two of them. The eight go over to the miners. The eight later are gone. You have to spend the entire...
Oh, is that what happens when you see somebody's paid a huge fee to a miner?
That's hopefully not very common, but that is one of the mistakes people make is when you're spending this, you know, so you send to these boxes, they're UTXOs. The UTXO has an address, you know, on it and an amount on it, but you can only spend the whole thing. You can't take a little bit out of the UTXO. The only thing you can do is spend all of it. So that's why in Bitcoin you have these change addresses where you're like, okay, I have five coins, I'm going to spend two, and the remaining three I'll put in a new box and put my own address on that.
So if I was using something like a Trezor or a Ledger, they do that automatically for me?
Generally, yeah. Most wallets will do that automatically and also make new addresses each time. So the idea is you're making a new UTXO. You're making a new box. There's no way around that.
Yeah.
You might as well slap a new address on it because the addresses are free. You make a new key. And there's, you know, BIP32. There's ways to make sort of deterministic series of keys where you only have to keep one private key, but you can have lots of public keys. And that helps privacy a bit. The address... It's a little counterintuitive, and you know, Satoshi certainly could have made it an account-based model the way Ethereum does. That works, but I've been working on this now for a year. I think it's a better model because you can do stuff like UTXO. It really lends itself towards accumulators much more so than the account-based model used in some other coins.
So what itself is an accumulator?
Okay, so an accumulator is... A set. So if you notice, a set is like a bunch of things where you can add things to it. And in this case, you can remove things from it, but it doesn't get bigger. So imagine a box where you can throw things into it, but it's sort of a bottomless box. And then people can prove that you threw something into it. So you're not able to sort through it yourself. So you're not able to, I got a bunch of pictures, let's say. Pictures from weddings, pictures from vacations. I throw them all into this box, but it's unlimited size. And then I can't get my pictures back out. So I can't remember a wedding or like what was he wearing? Like, I can't remember. However, if someone proves to me a picture, I will be able to verify that proof. So it's sort of like, I don't remember what he was wearing, but if you show me this picture, I'll be like, oh yeah, that was that was that wedding. And you haven't altered this picture. He was wearing a blue suit, not a gray suit. So it's a little weird in that, to some extent, a hash can be thought of as an... This is a bit of a stretch. But if you have the hash of a file, you don't remember the whole file, right? The hash is very small. But if someone presents that original file to you, you'll be like, yep, that's it. That was the file I stored. And nothing has been altered. And so it uses, you know, if you have hash functions, those are in some way do the same thing as an accumulator. But an accumulator does many discrete objects, can be sort of squished together into one accumulator. And while you don't remember all of them, when someone gives you a proof, you're like, yep, that was in there. Okay, got it.
Right, okay. So are there any risks with UTXO?
A little bit, in that it's not too bad, but you are relying on a bridge node. So what that means is when you're saying, hey, I need these proofs, the software right now has no idea what UTXO is. It doesn't do these proofs. No wallets deal with that. So you're going to need some nodes on the network to generate these proofs for you. And if all those nodes go away, you're stuck. And you can't continue on with the network. You don't lose your private keys, and no one can deceive you, but your software stops working, and you're going to have to go download the regular software and say, oh, well, we tried UTXO, and that sort of stopped working. No one liked it. And now I've got to download regular Bitcoin sync up, and it's going to take me a day or two. So that's certainly inconvenient, and that's certainly a, you know, denial of service vector. If you get rid of all the bridge nodes, the people using UTXO halt. And that can be very dangerous if you're a miner. And you are not able to, if you're a miner running UTXO and someone manages to sort of get you, push you off the network, well, now you can't mine anymore. So you know, those are dangers. I don't think they're too bad. I think, you know, the whole idea is running a bridge node shouldn't be too hard. It's like 8 or 10 gigabytes. You can run it on a laptop. If you have a bunch of them, probably you're going to be okay. But that is a risk, that it can sort of hit a wall and hit a dead end if those people stop using it.
Right, so a bunch of people will have to be incentivized to run a bridge node, as well as we have people running full nodes.
Yeah, so I'm not super enthusiastic about trying to make it like, oh, you could pay the bridge nodes. Like, yeah, but yeah. It's sort of like running an archive node right now. So running a full node, I think the incentive is I want to verify my payments. I don't want to trust anyone. I want to know that I'm getting Bitcoin. Running an archive node, it's less clear, right? You're storing hundreds of gigabytes. You're spewing out lots of data. So I run at work at MIT, I have a full node, and it's like 3 terabytes a month of outgoing data, serving data to all the people who want to download Bitcoin. And, it, you know, I don't pay for it. Mm-hmm. MIT has good internet, so sure. But that is somewhat costly. But right now, there's no incentive to do it. But there's still a lot of people that do because the cost isn't too high and, you know, it helps the network. So I think bridge nodes is going to be similar in that it's not that hard to run. You can run it on your laptop. It is going to take some more space. It's going to take some more network traffic, but similar to running an archive node now. So I think it's okay.
Okay.
Going forward, you may be able to split this up. And so there's ideas of, hey, right now, if you're running an archive node, it's kind of all or nothing. We should be able to make it split up so you take small portions of the blockchain and you can serve those. So there's ideas of how to do that. Similarly with bridge nodes, you can sort of chop it up so you can run a partial bridge node. So eventually, we'll probably have to program that.
Right, okay. Yeah. So what's the next steps of this now?
Yeah, so that's sort of the debate.
Do you essentially have to lobby people?
No, it's more programming, right? So
all right, okay.
I think it's if you present something, hey, here's a pull request, everything works, it's all tested, it's amazing, then that's sort of the lobbying is done for you. And they're like, oh, cool. But we're not there. So the current software is more of a proof of concept, sort of get the performance numbers. There's no real networking code yet. And so start to write that and then try to sort of incrementally get some of these ideas into Bitcoin Core. And it might, I hope it's not just me. So working with maybe James, maybe HurtYap at DCI is going to work on some of it. Digital Garage, they said they're interested. So I might work with Akale or Nakagawa there. So just, you know, work with other people to get this code working and maybe get it into Bitcoin Core.
How do you split the work up then? How do you decide? Is there like, because I'm not a coder, so
yeah.
I don't understand how this is constructed.
Well, so the sort of cryptographic accumulator, that's mostly working. That's not going to change. But then there's also messages between nodes to say, hey, I need a proof. Okay, here's the proof. And though the networking code, some people are really good at that. I have done that. I'm not as comfortable and
okay.
I don't really like it as much. I do like the cryptographic stuff more. But some people are like, no, I like networking stuff. And so maybe they can work on the messages between nodes to sync up the proofs and stuff like that. There's also how it hooks into Bitcoin Core, which I'm not as familiar with. Like, the Bitcoin Core code base is kind of huge now, and like I look at it, but there's people who are much more familiar than I am, and how it's going to sort of hook in. So Corey Fields would
right,
do that.
Right, so you can compartmentalize bits.
A bit, yeah.
So how long is it going to take to get this all coded up, do you think?
I don't know. I don't want to get...
Is it months?
A while.
Is it a year?
Yeah. So Bitcoin Core, I think getting a demonstration on testnet, yeah, I think you can have that this year. Getting it actually into Bitcoin Core, I don't think that'll happen this year.
Well,
Bitcoin Core is very, it's very conservative. It's hard to get stuff into it.
Yeah, and sensibly so.
Sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, is it a case of, does it have to be approved by people? Does certain people have to say, yeah, we agree with this, we like the code, we want it, or can it just be a case of, no, this won't become part of Core?
So it's not a fork. So if it's like a soft fork changes, like SegWit or Taproot, things like that, you really need to get everyone's approval. If it's the case that a bunch of people on Bitcoin Core said, sorry, man, it's too experimental. We think it's a cool idea, but it's just too scary. We're not going to put this in Core anytime soon. Then you can run a separate client. You could say, okay, we're going to make a separate wallet that's something like Electrum or something like its own wallet that talks to the U3XO network. And you can do that. I don't think that's the best. Like, that's possible, and I think that could be really interesting, and I might do something like that sort of to test. But doing that all and making a whole wallet and making it all work and have the assurance level that Bitcoin Core does, that's a lot of work. And I think it's probably less work to just get it into Core. But then again, like a testnet version. So I do think I'm going to sort of make a testnet version that just works without getting into Core. And the nice part is you don't have to get approval. So if it's not going to get into Core, yeah, people can still use it. People can make, you know, if the people who work on Electrum say, yeah, we like this idea, we're going to put it into Electrum.
Okay.
Cool, you can do that. Or other types of wallets can start using it. So it doesn't have to be like get into Core.
How long have you been working on Bitcoin? When did you
start? Depends when you start working. Like, so I learned about it in 2011 and then was like reading about it all the time in 2012 and, you know, starting program, but nothing that ever got used.
Right.
Until I started working on, you know, 2013, 14, I guess.
Right. Okay. Okay. So you've been there pretty much since the start, like 8 years.
Yeah, I guess it's a long time now. But it's like,
what do you make of it all now? Because, like, I mean, I discovered a lot later. I'm not a coder. I've never been involved in any coding of it. I'm more of an observer and a person who goes ask questions. But
journalist, kind of.
But you've been there pretty much from the start and seen what it's become in this kind of global phenomenon. Am I saying it right?
Phenomenon.
Yeah, what do you make of it all?
It's not what I expected to happen, sir. But I didn't know what I expected to happen. But it's pretty wacky. There's been a lot of like, how is this a thing? You know, like
How?
At some weird meeting in Hong Kong, and there's all these miners and like weird. You know, it's very sci-fi, which I think is good motivation to keep working on it because it's so wacky and like science fiction. And there's all these. It's also sometimes very frustrating. So like you see ICOs and like all these people getting rich, and you're like it can be frustrating because I didn't buy a bazillion bitcoins. Yeah, I should have, could have. Yeah. And so sometimes it's a little weird that it is, it can be frustrating that not so much in Bitcoin, but there's all these other things where, you know, people make a ton of money and people rip each other off. And it's like, yeah, Bitcoin enabled all this, right? Yeah. You wouldn't have had people losing all their money on these sketchy ICOs if it weren't for Bitcoin to start this whole thing off.
No, but scammers, it's not their fault. Yeah, but scammers are scammers, and right. they'll you know, sure. they tend to move from one scam to the other, you know. So I think some people would just be scamming with something else.
Sure. Yeah. So it didn't from the beginning, Bitcoin has had, you know, it's had a cast of characters. You know, mybitcoin.com was like the first sort of web wallet, and the name was very appropriate. It was My Bitcoin. It was that person's Bitcoin. They just took all the Bitcoins.
I don't know this story.
Oh, this is 2011. So 2011, you could download a full node, but there wasn't Electrum. There were no phone nodes. There wasn't blockchain on info. There wasn't anything.
So someone created it and just stole them all.
Yeah, mybitcoin.com. And it was hosted. It was custodial. All the private keys were on the website. You just sort of log in. And then one day, they just took it all.
How many did they get away with?
I don't remember, but thousands, I believe. But which wasn't that much then. And
if they hodled.
Sure, yeah. So there were things like that from the beginning. Lots of crazy stuff from the beginning. And, you know, BitcoinTalk.org was you know, sort of Mos Eisley, hive of scum and villainy for a while. I assume it still is. I don't look at it anymore because it's the signal-to-noise ratio has died a bit.
Yeah.
And that is something I worry about is that, like, we had this meeting in Amsterdam, and it's all the Core developers and people working on Bitcoin and Lightning, and it's invite only, which makes sense, right? You can't just let anyone come because there's all these crazy people that'll show up, and it just you'll never get anything done. But it is sort of
secret meeting,
yeah. Like, and you're like, oh, we don't want it to be a secret meeting. It shouldn't be this closed thing. But how do you do that, right? How do you get openness but keep crazy people and signal the noise and stuff like that?
Can't you just video it?
Yeah. So I don't there are open discussions as well. I think most of the stuff, like Brian Bishop wrote like everything that everyone said there.
He's amazing. The way he does that. It.
Yeah. So
how many people were there?
Maybe 30. So about the same as
lucky
before.
Lucky no one took that room down, because that would be all the key Bitcoin people gone.
Bitcoin would die. Yeah, it's weird. It's like sometimes you worry about security. So like, I don't think this one, but like other ones have had like security guards and stuff. And yeah. I'm like, do we really need that? Like, because it's weird working on it. I don't think it's important. I don't think anyone cares about this. But at the same time, it's like, wait, there's hundreds of billions of dollars on this, and like people, death threats and crazy stuff. I've never been exposed to that, which I'm thankful for. I generally keep fairly low profile. I don't like people. people don't think I work on. So, like, sometimes I've had to been like, I try not to be a jerk about it, but I'm like, no, I wrote the Lightning Network paper, like, you know, which awesome. But, like, sometimes people are like, no, you didn't. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, no, come on, I've been working on this. because people don't know me, and that's generally good. I don't, you know, there's no point in being, like, famous about it. But it's weird, because there is a sort of a disconnect where we're working on something that is worth a ton of money and people think is very important, but the people working on it aren't exposed to that at all. Most of the people who, you know, the thing like Amsterdam, we're working on the new software, making Bitcoin, there's no profit in it, right? If you make U3XO, you're not going to make a lot of money. If you make Lightning Network, the companies will spring up from it, cool, but like the fundamental research, there's no connection to profit. And I think that's how it should be, right? If U3XO were patented and now anyone who wants to use it has to pay me $5, well, people won't use it.
Yeah.
People will be like, oh, shoot, that sucks. That was a good idea, and now we're not going to use it.
Well, it was the same with zero knowledge proofs, wasn't it?
Some of the, yeah.
Yes, the Schnorr pitch part.
Zero knowledge proofs.
So we're only just getting that now.
Yeah, a lot of people patent stuff, and it's just like toxic waste. You're like, oh, well, I'm not going to even learn about that because I can't use it.
Craig Wright came out, I think, yesterday and said he's going, I think he said he's going to be suing Facebook because they are infringing on his blockchain patents.
Okay, well, that's okay. They can have fun fighting each other. But yeah, I patents, I mean, you know, general intellectual property can make sense, but I do think that software patents, and especially like mathematical algorithm patents, it just goes too far because you're really discovering things, not developing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You're right, because like, you shouldn't be able to patent math.
I agree that like in some cases patents the goal was, hey, we want to have people innovate and share their ideas so they can have like a limited monopoly on this idea, and then it goes to the world and it's well documented. But I just think in mathematics and cryptography it really doesn't apply.
I really like that what you said there, though, that you're not inventing things, you're discovering things, because it already exists.
Schnorr signatures, I feel like, because I remember with discrete law contracts, a paper I wrote 2 years ago, I sort of came up with a wacky signature scheme, ran it by people, and they were like, wait, is this really a new signature scheme? I'm like, oh, wait, this is just a Schnorr signature scheme that I sort of rediscovered. Because the equation's very simple. It's like the simplest, most optimal way to make a discrete log-based signature. And yeah, but it was patented. It's not anymore. The patent expired. Mm-hmm. And that's why we sort of joke, like, should we call it Schnorr signatures? This guy Schnorr had it patented, and that's why we're stuck with ECDSA, and that's why it exists, because it was patented, so people kept tweaking the algorithm and making it worse until the lawyer said, yeah, this doesn't infringe. and so it's like, but now he gets credit, right? It's called a Schnorr signature. And that's another sort of weird thing, like, I'm going to call it U3XO, and I'm going to call things Lightning Network. I'm going to make cheesy names for things, because you can sort of see when they make a paper and they, like, don't name it at all, that they're like trying a gun for like, hey, call it a Dryja signature or something.
Yeah.
and so like that's also like
the Touch Network.
And that's not as bad, right? If you try to get your name stuck on stuff, like, okay, fine. I don't think that's like hostile the way like patents are. But still, like, I don't know, it's a little weird.
I just love that thought. I've interviewed Andrew Polstra twice now, and both times it's been fascinating hearing him talk about math and Schnorr signatures and the things that I don't have a fucking clue what he's talking about most of the time, but it's so fascinating hearing about it. But that thought of discovering things is amazing, right?
Yeah,
you can't invent math.
It does. Well, because math can get creepy sometimes. Yeah. You're like, wait, someone set this up. Where, you know, like Euler's formula where like e to the pi, you know, it's got e and pi and I, you're like, no. And if you actually learn the reasons for it, you're like, okay, that makes sense. But how are all these things connected? You know, it's a little scary. Like, wait, who set this up? Like, is there some deity that made math work the way it does? Right? Because it's different than science, right? It's not observational. You've got proofs. You know that it's correct. So math is, you know, gets into philosophy and stuff, and it's fun, and it is really fun when you get something to work and you get an applicable thing. So like I'm more on the applied side. Andrew's a bit more theoretical, but also, you know, getting a lot applied. And so we work with a PhD student, Quan. She only cares about theory. She's like, oh yeah, I guess you could use it for something, but I just like the new math, right? and I could totally see that though, where the theoretical stuff itself, you're discovering new things about the universe.
So what else went on at the secret meeting then? What were the big topics in discussion. In
Amsterdam. So it wasn't. Permissioned, and you had to get invited, but it wasn't secret. People reported on. There was talk about another soft fork, right? Okay. So there was talk about, and this is, it's on Kanger's website, but there was talk about, hey, what if we have a sort of cleanup soft fork where we just fix some bugs, and then we make sure we can do a soft fork, and then later we'll do the Taproot Schnorr signature fork. Generally, that wasn't something people were on board with. It seems like, no, let's do this Schnorr and Taproot first, and then maybe after that do a cleanup fork. It was sort of, everyone was hesitant. Everyone's like, oh man, soft forks. We do have to do one again. But that's a really big mess because you're coordinating with the whole ecosystem. You can't just make improvements in the software, yeah.
Right, okay.
So there was talk about that. There was talk about a new messaging protocol, so like version 2, and Jonas Schnelli gave a presentation about that at Breaking Bitcoin. And people argued about that. Like the thing is, we argue about the little things, but the general idea was, yeah, we should do something like this. But everyone argues about the details. Wait, why is this a string? Shouldn't this be a fixed byte array? Shouldn't all the little things like
Does
that.
Does it get heated ever?
No, everyone's very friendly, but people start shouting, well, no, don't do this, don't do that. So generally, most people are on the same page. And that's what I said about soft forks. People worried a lot about, oh, SegWit was such a mess. The next one's going to be a problem. And I said, maybe not. Like, maybe the people who were very against these ideas have left, right? If all the people who really hated SegWit and hated the core developers are now using Bitcoin Cash, well, maybe it's easy to make a soft fork now, which is also a little scary,
yeah.
Right? If everyone who disagrees leaves and then you just have everyone on board, then that sort of feels like it gives a lot of power to the people who are programming Bitcoin, which is a little scary. And maybe in Ethereum is the same thing, where like if all the people who didn't like these ideas go to Ethereum Classic, mm-hmm. the only people left like the developers and go along with anything. I don't know to what extent that's true. And the developers are pretty conservative about this, but you never know.
All right, man. So what's coming next for UTXO then? You said you're going to be coding.
Yeah.
So anything else we need to keep an eye out on?
On GitHub, I will, I answer questions about it, maybe give some talks about it. I want to sort of get people interested in it because it's also applicable to not just Bitcoin. You could use it in other system, other blockchains, but maybe even other things that are not blockchains at all.
Are you going to Riga?
Riga? What is that?
For the Honey Badger.
No.
HODL conference.
No, is that like
the Baltic Honey Badger conference, yeah.
Okay, I haven't...
It's in September. That'd probably be a good one to present it.
I might go to... I need to figure out if I'm going to Scaling Bitcoin in Israel in September.
If it's... Yeah, because that probably suits being presented at Scaling Bitcoin as it's a scaling proposal.
Yeah, so I just need to figure out. So talk about it. And then hopefully get other people looking at it. So like part of why I'm not working on Lightning is there's tons of people working on Lightning.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, cool. Like would I be helping or would I just be arguing with people and be like, no, I'll do it my way.
Yeah, but like you said to me last time also that Lightning's, you don't agree exactly with some of the decisions.
But I mean, it's the same thing. Like, yes, it's probably like if I made it myself, I'm like, no, do it this way.
Close to it because you wrote the white paper?
Yeah, so same with UTXO. Eventually, there's going to be stuff and like maybe I'll argue and like, but it's little things, right? The general idea is there. People focus on the disagreements because that's what you disagree on, right? That's what you argue about. But 99% is the same ideas. So.
Right, okay.
So try to get other people looking at it. Try to start coding with other people and get into Bitcoin and then run Bitcoin nodes on Raspberry Pis or who knows.
All right, so how do people find out more about it and how do they stay in touch with UTouch?
The paper's up on ePrint, so I'm sure if you just search UTXO. Yeah. And then there's also the GitHub, so MIT.DCI/UTXO, where I'm writing code on it, and there's been like 2 pull requests. Not a ton of people looking at it. I'm trying to clean it up so it's more readable and obvious, but if you have questions about it, ask on GitHub, and I'll try to put comments or try to restructure the code so it's easier to understand or start using it, yeah.
It's a cool name as well, UTXO.
I mean, it's pretty... Nehat really didn't like that name. She was like, no, it's really cheesy.
I like it.
I think it says what's on the tin, right? It's like, oh, yeah. It's UTXOs, and there's a tree of them. Yeah. Actually, a bunch of trees.
But it's memorable as well.
Yeah, it's a cheesy name, so yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
I think we initially wanted to call it, like, Radical Nodes, because there was a Radix tree, but there's not a Radix tree anymore, so...
Yeah. No, I think you've got it right. All right, man. Well, listen, thanks for coming on
sure.
again, Ted.
Yeah, great, thanks.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Did you enjoy what Taj had to say? I got to say, as a non-techie, he's one of the easiest people to interview. A bit like Andrew Polstra, it's very easy to talk to him about techie things and get him to explain it in a way that even an idiot like me can understand. And you know what? Taj is doing a lot for the space. After co-writing the Lightning White Paper, he's now working on other projects which aim to improve Bitcoin. And it was great to chat to someone who does so much for the industry. I always find it super interesting talking about how people's careers have evolved, how they've ended up working in Bitcoin, and Taj was no exception. It's really impressive to look at the journey that he's been on and where he's at now. And during the conversation, I learned something new. I learned something about addresses I didn't know, and maybe everyone knew this, and it's just me. Maybe I'm just an idiot, or maybe some of you didn't know. But there were a couple of points Taj made that were new to me. I didn't realize that block explorers can be a bit misleading, that your Bitcoin addresses don't carry any balances, and it's just an unspent transaction output. That was new to me. Anyway, thanks, Taj. I know this was a little high level at some points, but I know there's some techies that listen to this and you're probably fine with it. And hopefully for the non-techies, you got something out of it as well. You know you can reach out to me if you've got any questions. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And big thanks to everyone who supports the show. So many of you do so many things, whether you write me an email, you drop me a DM, leave me a review. It doesn't matter what you do. Everything helps support the show and has helped it become one of the leading shows in Bitcoin. But if you do want to support the show, if you listen to every episode and you want to do something, just head over to my website. It's whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. It tells you everything you can do. But it's pretty easy. I mean, firstly, you can check out the ads. It's the sponsors that pay for me to do this. I know some people don't like ads, but without it, I wouldn't be able to fly out and do these amazing interviews. You can also become a patron if you don't like the ads. Just head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. It's about $5 and you get the shows ad-free. You don't even get all my nonsense talking. If you don't want to use Patreon, if you want to subscribe by crypto, get in touch. I'll give you a deposit address. It can be Lightning if you want, and I'll add you to the distribution list. You can buy some merchandise. Got some stuff up on the website. Check that out. You can become a show sponsor. Pretty much all of my ads are sold out, but I'm looking for people for next year. I know that sounds silly, but reach out if you are interested. Podcast is regularly doing 200,000 downloads a month now, which is amazing and kind of crazy. You can leave me a review on iTunes and you can click on the subscribe button. Super helpful. You can follow me on social media. I'm at WhatBitcoinDid everywhere, but I've got a personal Twitter account, which is at Peter McCormack. You can check out my website, whatbitcoindid.com. You can sign up to my newsletter. And most of all, you can share this out with your friends and family. If you do any of this, I love you and I adore you. If you don't, then I hate you and I hope you burn in hell. No, I don't. I'm only joking. So, yes, look, thank you to everyone who helps with the show. It's truly amazing. I really do appreciate it. As I said, I'm probably back off to the States next week. I've got some amazing interviews coming up. I've also got an amazing interview I recorded with Jack Mallers and his mum and dad. It was kind of super funny. I look forward to you hearing that. See what you think about that one. And yeah, any questions, as ever, you can reach out to me. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com.